Hi, I'm Lisa Davis. Welcome back to It's Your Health on Thinking Out Loud on WUML 91.5 FM. Are you happy? It is a question today's guest, Gretchen Rubin, asked herself one day while sitting on a bus in New York City. Gretchen is here to talk about her inspiring book, The Happiness Project, or Why I Spent a Year Trying to Sing in the Morning, Clean My Closets, Fight Right, Read Aristotle, and Generally Have More Fun. In addition to The Happiness Project, Gretchen is also the author of the best-selling 40 Ways to Look at Winston Churchill and 40 Ways to Look at JFK. Rubin began her career in law, and she was clerking for Supreme Court Justice Sandra Day O'Connor when she realized she really wanted to be a writer. Gretchen, welcome to It's Your Health on Thinking Out Loud on 91.5 FM.
Well, thank you very much. I'm very happy to be here.
Oh, good. I'm happy to. Now, Gretchen, in your wonderful book, The Happiness Project, you write, quote, "One April day on a morning, just like every other morning, I had a sudden realization," unquote. What was that realization?
You know, I realized that although if I asked myself, what did I want from life, I'd say, I want to be happy. I realized I didn't spend any time thinking about whether I was happy or what I even thought it meant to be happy or whether there were things that I could do to make myself happier. And I realized if this is what I think is the most important thing, I need to devote a little bit more attention to it. And that's why I decided to have a happiness project.
Oh, okay. You know, another thing that you wrote that I really liked, you said, quote, "I wasn't depressed and I wasn't having a midlife crisis, but I was suffering from midlife malaise, recurrent sense of discontent, and almost a feeling of disbelief." And I totally related to that, you know, that midlife malaise feeling. You're not really depressed, but
right,
there's definitely something that's going on. So you thought about this, and you write also that you, before you had got started, that there were two crucial questions. Is it possible to make yourself happier, and what is happiness? How was it to answer those questions? Was it difficult?
Well, it was super fascinating. The research on happiness, you know, whether it's the current scientific studies, which are fascinating, or, you know, the wisdom from 2,000 years ago, which is equally fascinating. It was so much fun to delve into that. And so on the first question, is it possible to make yourself happier, I realized that, yes, it is. You know, it's true that, like, 50% of happiness has a very strong genetic component. And we all know people that are sort of naturally more bouncy and cheerful and people that are naturally a little bit more Eeyore-ish.
Yeah.
But everybody's got a range.
Yes.
And everybody can do things that are going to push themselves up to the top of their range or push themselves down to the bottom of their range. And a great way to think about this in everyday life is say to yourself, have I ever had a friend who had a job that they really hated?
Mm-hmm.
And how happy were they? And then if they got a job that they really liked, how happy were they? So they're the same person, the same temperament. But things that you do with your ordinary day, little things, big things, can push you up or down. And so I think the question is, well, can you be happier? And for practically everybody, the answer is, yeah, I could be happier. I did this, I did that. So that was interesting.
So what you did was, when I really like this, is that you had a blank chart, which I want you to tell about. And you also focused on a different subject each month. So you had 12 slots to fill. And you came up with a subject, then you had little elements of those. And if you can tell us first about the blank chart and its role in the Happiness Project.
Well, I was very inspired by Benjamin Franklin, who's just the most wonderful character and a great a patron saint, for sure, of Happiness Projects. And what Benjamin Franklin did is he had 13 virtues that he wanted to cultivate in himself. And so he made a chart, and it had the days of the week on one axis and the virtues that he wanted to cultivate on the other axis. And every day he would give himself a check mark about whether he'd practiced silence or temperance or frugality or whatever his founding father era type virtues were. And he would just give himself, just check it off. And I thought this was a great idea. So I modified it a little bit, and I made it for the whole month. And then I would put my resolutions on it. And every day I would say, well, did I sing in the morning? Did I not expect praise or appreciation? Did I refrain from gossiping? And I would just check myself that way. And I think what it did is it gave me the accountability. Because you can resolve all you want, but, and I think we all make, you know, have made lots of New Year's resolutions that we didn't keep. But the question is, how do you keep the resolution? And for me, that chart was a really, really important tool in just helping me, first of all, remember my resolutions, because sometimes they don't pop into your head at the right times. And if you're constantly reviewing them, they're kind of in your head more.
Oh, yeah.
And then if you're checking, if you're saying, okay, I did it or I didn't do it, then that helps you do a better job of sticking to what it is that you're trying to accomplish.
Yeah, and you also had 12 commandments. And if you can tell us some of those, and which one was the easiest to adhere to and which one was the hardest?
Wow. Well, the first, I think the most important of my 12 is the first one, which is be Gretchen. And people sort of laugh at that because they're like, well, why should I be Gretchen because I'm Kevin or whatever. But be Gretchen means be myself. And what I really realized is that this idea of knowing yourself is one of the most ancient principles of happiness. And you'd think, what could be more easy than knowing yourself? But it's actually very hard to know yourself, but it's really important if you're trying to build a happy life, because if you're not acknowledging your true nature and what really makes you happy, then you can't have a foundation for a happy life. Like, if you keep pretending that you're adventurous and love to go outside and go camping, and what you really love to do is, you know, read in bed, you're not going to be doing the things that make you happy. And it's surprisingly easy to lose track of what you really enjoy and what you really like and really how you like to spend your time. It's amazing to me how easy it is. But I have many people on my blog who say, I don't really know what I find fun.
Yeah.
And like, they don't, how can you have fun in your life if you don't even know what is fun for you? There must be something, so you have to find it. So be Gretchen was my first one. Another one is let it go, which is just, don't harp, don't nag, don't yell, just let it go. Stay detached, right? Easier said than done, but.
Mm-hmm.
And this is act the way I want to feel. This was a major strategy that I learned from my research. And this is a very widely understood psychological principle, but you can really put it to good practical use. We think that we feel, that we think that we act because of the way that we feel. But in fact, in many ways, we feel because of the way that we act. If you act angry, you're telling your brain, wow, I'm really angry. I know I'm really angry because I'm throwing things and I'm yelling and I'm slamming doors. I must be really, really angry. And if you, but you can use that to your advantage. So let's say you feel very shy, but you need to go into a social situation. If you just say to yourself, I'm just going to fake it till I feel it. I'm just going to fake feeling friendly. I'm just going to act like a friendly person. I'm just going to talk with energy. I'm just going to join conversations. I'm going to just make myself laugh. You will start to feel more that way. It will actually influence your emotions to the point that they've done studies that suggest that people who've had Botox don't feel as much anger because they can't make angry, frowning faces. So it's a great thing to try. If you're feeling annoyed, act thoughtful. If you're feeling angry, act calm. And you can really influence your emotions that way.
Oh, I love that. You know, and another thing that I love, I mean, there's so, your book was so wonderful, and I want to start my own happiness project.
Oh,
but
great. Good,
you know, you talk about people, you know, like Henry David Thoreau, who moved to Walden Pond to make this big change. And I love how you write, quote, I didn't want to reject my life. I wanted to change my life without changing my life by finding happiness in my own kitchen. And that's exactly what you were just talking about, is in your everyday situations, getting a different attitude or faking it until you feel it. And I thought that was interesting because so many people make these big changes, take themselves out of their lives instead of changing it without changing it.
Or they feel like they can't really take a step because if it's not possible for them to do something radical, they feel like it's not, it's not even worth starting. It's like, well, if I can't do, you know, if I can't do a week-long silent meditation retreat, there's just no point. Whereas, you know, sometimes that works and sometimes that's what you need or that's fantastic. But sometimes it's not what you need and sometimes it's just not possible. You know, you just can't do, you can't move to Walden Pond for 2 years and live by yourself.
Yeah.
Because for a lot of people, that's just not the way their lives are set up. But there's still things, like you say, that you can do in your ordinary life that can make you happier. Even if you don't, even if you're not going to take a radical step.
Yes. And, you know, another thing that I loved is you say, quote, one of my goals for the Happiness Project was to prepare for adversity, to develop the self-discipline and mental habits to deal with a bad thing when it happened. How did you come to realize that I guess being happier overall, was that going to help you when these things, bad things happened?
Well, I think it just, like any kind of preparation, it's the time, it's like savings, right? It's like you don't need your savings when you've got an income, and it's only when your income is gone that you realize that you wish you had those savings. And it's kind of the same thing with happiness. I think if you sort of do all the things that take some energy to instill these habits in your life, like going to sleep on time or exercising or keeping your house fairly orderly or not being in the habit of doing a lot of yelling or things like that before there's a major stress in your life, then when the major stress comes, then you have kind of these safety nets that are in place that will help you. It's like friends, you know. It's like when you really need your friends, they have to be there already. You can't make a friend because you need a friend.
Yes.
That's not the time when you're going to be able to go out to lunch or send an email or show up at a party. So I think, and it's interesting, I asked this question on my blog once because I wondered, did people who were facing major happiness challenges think that the kind of stuff that I was talking about was sort of trivial? Because I talk about things like making your bed or, you know, and a lot of people who had major happiness challenges said, no, this is good. Do this now and build it up and build your happiness now. And then even when you're facing a happiness challenge, if you can try to do these things, it can help get you through it. So these little things can really be helpful when you face those major challenges.
Oh, that's great. Because I know that you did have some challenges with some health issues in your family, and I'm glad that you were able to have this help you at those, you know, at times of adversity. Now, another thing, I swear, I love, you know, I read all the books, obviously, the people come on my show, and yours, there was just like so many things to quote, but I think people don't want to hear me just read quotes,
well,
but I have to read this one.
That's great to hear, though. I love that.
Well, this one cracks me up. Quote, love is a funny thing. I donated a kidney to Jamie, that's your husband, without a moment's hesitation, but I was intensely annoyed if he asked me to make a special stop at the drugstore to pick up shaving cream. That is, I'm sure everyone out there is laughing because it's so true. It's like, I love my husband so much and my daughter. Oh my gosh, I would do anything. I'd give my life, you know, but I just, you want me to go get that right now? I'm tired. Leave me alone.
Yeah, I know. Isn't it? It's funny.
That was so funny. That cracked me up. And another thing that I loved is you had some anti-nagging techniques. We only have a few minutes left. The time goes so fast. If you can just share a couple of those, I'm sure that would be great.
Well, one thing is, part of the things that's bad about nagging is just hearing that voice and yay, 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 yay. So one thing my husband and I try to do is when we have nagging tasks for each other, we try to indicate it without words. So, like, I'm always the one who goes by the drugstore, and so my husband leaves a prescription for me to fill on the counter in a certain place. And he's always the one that replaces light bulbs because he's taller. And so I put a light bulb on the counter. And then it's like, don't say anything more. I just leave it there. And you just leave it there as this silent reproach until the person does it.
Oh, I like that.
Another one is just to say one word instead of to yammer on. So you just say, milk, instead of saying, remember, I told you, da-da-da-da-da. And another thing is, like, if you're not doing it yourself, don't complain. So if you want somebody to do something and they do it in a way that's not the way you would have done it, if you want to do it your way, do it yourself. If somebody does it their way, that's fine. You know, like if your spouse gets your child ready for school and that child is wearing an outfit but it's an, you know, glaring eyesore, that was up to them. That was not your chore, not your responsibility, so you have to just let it go. And unfortunately, the most effective anti-nagging technique is the least popular one, which is to do it yourself.
Oh.
And I find that in many occasions, I'm like, why am I the queen of the world that gets to tell my husband what to do? If I want him to do it, actually, I should be the one to do it.
Exactly.
And in the end, that is a much more peaceable way of doing it. Within reason, you can't do everything that way. But there's a lot of things I found that... I just did it myself.
Oh, that's good. Well, you know, Gretchen, I swear the time goes way too fast. I want to encourage everyone, get the Happiness Project. Start your own Happiness Project. Tell us the website and for your blog so people can check it out.
Oh, right. The blog is www.happiness-project.com. But you can also just search under the Happiness Project, and it'll pop up right away.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Gretchen. This was super fun. I feel very happy.
Oh, well, me too. This is a great way to start the day.
All right. Well, take care.
Okay.
Have a great day. And everyone, keep listening. Kathy Buady is going to be up, Breathless in the City, her wonderful book, in just a moment. Hi, I'm Lisa Davis. Welcome back to It's Your Health on Thinking Out Loud on WUML 91.5 FM. How many of you are fans of the hit HBO show Sex and the City? Well, I love that show, and I loved watching Carrie, Samantha, Charlotte, and Miranda navigate the dating scene in New York City. Well, imagine being in the New York dating scene, or any dating scene for that matter, while being treated for breast cancer. Today's guest, Kathy Buetti, did just that. Kathy is the author of Breastless in the City. Women's World Magazine writes, quote, Breastless in the City shows other young women how they can cope with loss of love, of a breast, of whatever matters most. Kathy, welcome to It's Your Health on Thinking Out Loud on WUML 91.5 FM.
Thanks, Lisa. I'm glad to be here. Thanks for having me on the show.
I'm so glad to have you. You know, Kathy, I absolutely loved your book. I couldn't put it down. I cried. I laughed. It was just so touching, and everything that you've gone through. And if you can start and just tell us a little bit about your life before you got your breast cancer diagnosis, and a little bit about your life with your first husband, Paul.
Sure. I grew up with a father that was a bad alcoholic, and I met my first husband when I was 15 in high school, and we started dating then on and off, split for a little while, and then when I was in college, going to college for OT, we got back together, and then we're together from there on out. We got engaged while I was in college. We got married when I was 23 years old. And had, you know, been working at my first job as a therapist at a local hospital, and he had gone to school for respiratory therapy, and so we were, you know, beginning our life together. We got married on Halloween of 1992, and then only, it was 2 years later, it was Labor Day, so it was just shy of our second anniversary. He and his younger brother were both killed in a head-on collision not that far from our house, maybe 5 or 10 minutes away. They were on their way back to our house. His brother was 18 years old at the time, and my husband was 26, and my brother-in-law was driving the car. He had survived only a few hours past my husband. My husband was killed instantly, and my brother-in-law died that night, so they both passed away on the same day. So that was that was the worst thing, even to this day, that I've ever gone through.
Oh
yeah, and so there I was,
so
you know, with a house and, you know, trying to figure out how I was going to get on with the rest of my life without him, how I was going to survive emotionally, how I was going to survive financially, like all these things, you know, running through my head. I was only 25 years old, and then it took a long, long time for me to, you know, pick myself up and get myself back out into the world, and working was a big help. You know, I went back to work right away, and that was something that helped me to have, you know, some semi-sense of a normal routine. And so at the time I remember thinking, you know, this is, okay, so at least I'm getting the bad stuff, the worst thing that could ever happen to me, out of the way early. You know, I'm 25 years old, and I had this awful thing happen. So I thought it was going to give me, stupidly thought it was going to give me immunity for the rest of my life to be, you know, smooth sailing, because it was such a difficult thing I had gone through. And so 7 years later, when I was 31, I found a lump in my breast. And at the time, I was in the middle of, you know, I had started online dating 2 years before. I was just getting myself back out there. I was taking writing classes and photography workshops, and I was going out with my friends, and I was really starting to feel like, wow, you know, I'm starting to feel okay about my life and feeling better. And then I found the lump in my breast, and I thought, this can't be happening. This can't be what I am afraid it is. And so instinctively, I felt like it was something bad, and I was in denial for a couple of months about it, and I was really scared to go to the doctor, but I found out it was stage 2 breast cancer. So,
oh, my gosh. You know,
yeah.
It's just getting yourself back out there and getting your life. Mm-hmm. And you know what you said earlier? I've been there before, where something bad happens. Like, I lost my mother and then my grandfather when I was in my 20s, 6 months apart. And I thought, this is it. Like, nothing else bad. You know, and so I understand that. But then other bad things have happened. I'm like, wait a second. But that was really, really horrible. How could you say so? I completely, and I'm sure listeners understand that as well. And I just want to say, I'm so sorry for your loss and, you know, what you've had to go through.
Thank you.
Now, one thing that did, I thought, found a really interesting was how your father, though, actually came to your assistance in both the situation. Wasn't he the first one there when you found out about Paul? He came to your home. Is that correct? And then he was with you with the cancer. And that must have been really interesting because of the way your relationship had been previously.
Right. Our relationship was very, very difficult. At the time that the accident happened, I was not really even barely on speaking terms with him. He lived right down the street from my husband and I. He had remarried and was living there with his wife. My parents divorced when I was in college. My father drank heavily up until the time I was about 13 years old, and then he had quit drinking, amazingly quit drinking, or he probably would have died a lot sooner. But he never really dealt with, you know, the reasons why he drank, and he was, you know, a dry drunk. He was just still very unhappy, and you know, so he moved on, and but it was always a strain between he and I. I had a lot of anger towards him, and you know, so for him, I mean, he was the first one that I called because he lived the closest, and you know, he came over that day when the police were at my house, and went with me when we went to the hospital, and all of that awful stuff. And then, you know, strangely, I mean, it was like a very weird moment, you know, that I had when he showed up at my house just as doing a pop-in to see how I was doing. He wasn't even in the area. He was on his way back from a workshop at his job and stopped by, and he never did that. I had already had the biopsy, and when he stopped by, he was calling to, you know, stopping in to see how I was, and he literally, like, knocked on the door. I think it was maybe like 5 or 10 minutes after I got the call from the doctor's office to come in for my results, which, you know, it's like when you get called to the principal's office, you know you're in trouble. So I knew that it was bad. And he showed up at the door, and he's like, I said, oh, I'm on my way out. Oh, you know, what happened? And I said, I'm going to the doctor. Do you want me to take you? And so I said, no, I'll go by myself, you know, because I was all like, I'm going to be independent, you know, leave me alone. And I didn't really want his help, but I let him drive me there. He's like, no, I'll go. And so, and then I remember thinking on the way home, after we got the awful news, I was in the car with him, and I said, can you believe that you and I are driving back from something else awful that has happened to me? How can this be happening? And it was just a very strange synchronicity moment, I think, that he actually showed up there at my door. And so he was there every day I was in the hospital. He took me to every chemo treatment, so present in my life. But then when I was okay and I was doing well, I didn't hear from him. We didn't speak. It was a very, you know, he was always there during the crisis times, which now I see that I'm grateful for that. But I was always very sad and angry that he couldn't be there when things were good, because he wasn't. But if something awful happened, he was like right there. So it was a very strange relationship. And he's since passed away about a year and a half of pancreatic cancer. That was, you know, difficult to go through with him. Having been somebody that went through cancer and survived it, to watch a parent go through it and not survive was a, I still have a tough time with it.
Oh yeah, of course. You know, it's interesting too, because you got diagnosed, you said you were 31, and I know we, you know, one of your doctors said, quote, I'd be really surprised if it's cancer. You're too young to have breast cancer, so you shouldn't worry. Why is that so prevalent? I've heard that from other young women I've interviewed as well who've had breast cancer. It just seems like, don't these doctors know that? You're not too young? I was really baffled by that.
And this was eight years ago that I got diagnosed. And, I mean, I didn't realize, you know, how prevalent it was. But with young people, there's not enough there's not enough out there about, you know, young women getting breast cancer. So when I've heard so many times a young woman goes to the doctor, the doctor's like, oh, you're too young, so they dismiss these lumps that they're finding, and then they send them away, and then they say, well, come back in 6 months if it's not gone, and we'll check it then. And by then, if it was cancer, you know, cancer is more aggressive in young people, so it's progressed to the point where they're at a later stage, and you know, it really affects their survival. But doctors really need to be more aware and listen. And I always tell other young women, you know, if you find a lump, go to a doctor, and if he dismisses it, go to somebody else and go to somebody else until you get somebody that will listen and follow up and do a mammogram or do a breast MRI or do a biopsy or whatever it is until you get the answer. You know, it's really scary. It's amazing how many young people get dismissed with their symptoms. I still, you know, there's a girl that I work with, the same thing happened to her, and you know, she it was dismissed, and then by the time she went back, it was a lot worse because it was cancer. And so it's very scary. I was lucky that I found a doctor that, even though he said you're too young, it's probably nothing, I still was taken through all of the steps. And, you know, the other thing I think is hard is that when you hear from a doctor that it's probably nothing, that's what you want to hear because you're so scared.
Exactly.
You know, so I think that when you're told that by a doctor, you're thinking, well, the doctor should know what he's talking about. This is what I'm going through. He's the expert.
You'd hope so.
And then, you know, and then when you hear something that, oh, well, it's probably nothing, maybe for a little while it might make you, you know, feel okay. You know, because it did make me feel like, oh, okay, he doesn't think it's anything. And I don't know. I think it's hard because there's so much fear that I think for some people they might not pursue it further, you know, and be more aggressive because of fear, you know. So,
oh,
but
yeah.
it's really the doctors that need to be more aware and listen to young people and really take them through the, you know, the process to really find out if it is indeed nothing or if it's cancer, because it can really affect survival.
Oh,
right?
Yeah. And another thing you mentioned, too, that's important, is that one of the reasons also, aside from your being young, is that the lump was soft and movable. And
well,
they say that, was that it? And they say that usually doesn't indicate cancer, but in your case it did. So
right,
women should be aware of that.
Right. That was the other, in my case, what was really scary was, and it probably was the only way that I found it. When I found it, I was in the shower doing I called it a poke around, because I never did self-exams, you know, I never did them. But I happened to find it, and it was the size of a marble. It was pretty big, and I was startled. Mm. But it felt soft, and I can move it around under the skin. And I know from having a medical background, I was like, oh, okay, I can move it around. It's soft and movable. That's not typical of cancer. Cancer is, like, hard, you know, feels like a rock, and it doesn't move. So
okay.
When I went to these doctors, that's also what they were going by. But when they did my biopsy, for whatever reason, I was lucky that I didn't have a needle biopsy. The surgeon that I went to said, I'm going to take it out. And I was like, okay. He took it out, and it was 4 centimeters was the lump. 1 centimeter was cancer inside encapsulated in fat tissue. So that's why it was soft and movable. If he had gone in with a needle, he might have missed it, because it was 3 centimeters of fat, and the cancer was, luckily it was small, but it was hidden inside, and that's why how it was disguised. So in my case, the soft movable was what they were, you know, kind of going by. So it's really, you never know. I mean, in that instance, I'm a perfect example of, you know, you never know. So I always tell young women or anybody, follow your instincts. If you have a bad feeling, you know, just go to somebody that will listen, you know, because I had a bad feeling. A lot of times we ignore them, especially, you know, when they're bad feelings, you know. So, so in my case, it proved that theory was not true.
Yeah, and the other thing interesting, too, is even with Paul, you had a bad feeling. You were
I think
you said you were at a therapy appointment, and she was dismissive. She was like, oh, you know, because you're like, he should have been home, but there was this traffic. And I just, it's really, we got to listen to that inner voice. So you find this horrible news out, and yet you were starting to date.
Mm-hmm.
But I know that, I'm sure it's okay to ask because it's in the book, but some of the relationships were less than ideal. Because I think you were finding men that just weren't exactly communicative, I guess is a way to put it. I'm trying to find a nice way to put this, Kathy.
You're being nice.
Yeah. But I can't swear on the radio. There are a bunch
right,
of...
Right.
No. But I was just... I couldn't believe some of the stuff that you went through. And I understand at the same time, though, because you didn't want to be alone, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I was, you know, so you were in this dating scene. And I know there was one point where you did find a guy who was nice, but then you told him. And he just couldn't handle it. If you can tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, he was really nice, and it was actually, I mean, I wasn't fessing up that I had cancer until I really looked the part, you know, which was when my hair started to fall out, and I was like, okay, you know, because I really struggled with disclosure issues. When do you tell a guy? I mean, I had nobody that I was talking to. I didn't know any other young people that were dating with cancer. You know, when do you tell a person? Do you wait till, you know, a few dates or see where it's going? And while I didn't look the part, you know, I hadn't told this guy, and I went on my first date with him, I think it was after I had my first chemo treatment, and we went to Central Park, and I was popping Zofran for my nausea. I had had a treatment, like, on a Tuesday, and the date was on a Saturday, and I was exhausted and I was tired, but I really wanted to go ahead and meet him, and we had a nice date, but I was really trying to hold it together. At one point I was, you know, kind of walking a little hunched over because I had abdomen surgery for my reconstruction.
And he was
like, are you okay? And I said, yeah, I just did too many sit-ups the night before. And I'm like, you know, I'm like telling these, like, you know, I was not being honest with him. And he's like, oh, okay. And I'm thinking, I wish it was only from some sit-ups that I did, you know, and not from surgery. So when it came to the point where my hair was really starting to shed, we had scheduled like another date. I think it was the second or third date when I told him. I cut my hair really, really short. And I remember telling my friend before the day, I'm like, look at my hair. He's going to notice. And I'm so upset. And I'm thinking to myself, you should be grateful, you know, that you still have hair on your head, you know, for this date, because you're going to be bald next. And so sure enough, like a guy, when I see him, I have this short pixie haircut from long hair. He doesn't even say a word about it. And then I was like, wow, I'm so insulted that he didn't notice my hair. And then in another instance, I was like, are you crazy? You should be grateful that he didn't notice your hair, because you're going to be bald in a few days, you know?
Oh,
so at the end of the date, I end up telling him that I had breast cancer, and it was that night I asked him if I could stay over because I didn't want to drive all the way home. And I remember, telling him, because my hair was shedding so bad, I was, like, pre-apologizing for hair that I might leave on his pillow. It was so awful because I woke up and there was shedding hair all over his pillow, and the guy looked, like, totally freaked out. And he told me before I left, he's like, you know, I really like you, but I just can't handle this, and I'm sorry. And so, I mean, I appreciated his honesty and the kind way that he had about it. I was angry, I think, at cancer, because I was thinking if it wasn't for cancer, who knows what would happen, you know, in this instance. So he handled it a lot better than some of the other guys.
Oh my
who
gosh.
Were just jerks.
Oh God, horrible.
Yeah.
Yeah, like,
horrible.
Kathy, oh my gosh.
People think, did you? I'm like, I didn't make that up. That really,
I know,
happened.
It's
that's
yeah.
really what he said. You
yeah,
know?
I'm not giving it away. You get people
who
ought to read the book. Seriously. But what I am going to give away, we only have a few minutes left, is that you did meet your wonderful husband, Paul.
Yes.
And if you can just tell us a little, because again, people should read the book, you know, but
yes.
just a little bit about that.
My husband Paul was my first husband. My husband Lou.
Oh God, I'm sorry.
No, that's
Lou.
Okay.
Oh my goodness, sorry about that.
I met Lou at the end of my chemo treatment. I think I had just had my last one, so no eyelashes, no eyebrows, bald head, and so I met him online. And in the first conversation, at that point, I had said, you know what, I'm going to tell them right up. I can't hide it anymore. I'm going to be really honest because I've been so burnt by that point. And so when I was online, I was telling him, I have breast cancer, you know, I have a bald head, and I lost my breast, and I have reconstruction and all this stuff, and I'm telling him, and I'm expecting, well, you know, he'll tell me whether he still wants to talk to me or meet with me. And so he sent me a message back, and he was really supportive. He was like, oh, he's like, well, it's good that you caught it early. It's, you know, it's so much better survival if you catch it early. And he said, I just lost my mom to breast cancer. And so I sat at the computer, and I went, oh, my God, this poor guy. He's not going to want to meet somebody or date somebody that just, you know, that has the same disease that his mom passed away. It was only a month before we met online that his mom had died of breast cancer. And I found out later that she wasn't vigilant about her health. She let her symptoms go. She never had mammograms done. She was 57 years old. But so anyway, so he still wanted to meet, and we started dating, you know, really quickly after that. And then it was only, you know, 6 months later that, you know, we got engaged, and it happened like very, very quickly. But he just was so, he could really just see past, you know, all the outside. You know, it sounds cliche, but really, I mean, I was just really not looking that good at that point. And, you know, bald head, no eyelashes, no eyebrows, and you know, the scars that I had and things like that. But he was, I mean, just a really special guy that I feel very lucky to have met. And, you know, I always think that things that I go through happen for a reason. That's what I believe my whole life. And I think that philosophy has helped me get through what I've gone through. It teaches me about myself. You know, if things had been different, I wouldn't be who I am, and you know, things like that. So, so there's a good ending to the dating stuff by the time I meet him. So.
Oh, and you two are such a cute couple, I tell you. Yeah, he's really handsome, and you're beautiful.
Yeah.
And, you know,
thank
Kathy,
you.
I just want to thank you so much. I want to encourage everyone to get Breastless in the City, A Young Woman's Story of Love, Loss, and Breast Cancer. It's so inspirational. And, again, you're going to get mad at these jerks in there, but you found a great guy, and you deserve it.
I
hope you have a wonderful day. And everyone, thank you so much for listening. Now, next Tuesday, 12:22, we're going to be joined by April Benson, who is a psychologist who works with folks with compulsive shopping issues. And she wrote a wonderful book, To Buy or Not to Buy, that we're going to talk about in time for the holidays. And also a woman named Denise Didier, who is a cancer survivor. She's actually battling cancer with no insurance. And she's going to share her story with us. So everyone have a great week. Keep being healthy. Bye-bye.